Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
This week on RealityCast, I'll be interviewing Martha Burke on her new book on women voters, looking at the Pennsylvania primary through the reproductive rights lens, and giving the Today Show more beef about the relentless promotion of tired gender stereotypes. Also, Wisdom of Wingnuts starts a Mark Rudoff firing watch. Just a note, next week there will be no podcast. I am taking a week-long vacation in New York City, so I will not be able to record a podcast, but I will be back the week after that. So stay tuned. On the haphazard shout-outs to other podcasts thing I've got going here, I thought I'd plug another favorite. Sex is Fun. Most of their show is sex and dating advice, but they got political recently with a program on abstinence-only sex education.
I want to tell you how much money has been spent on this. This is the amount of money that has been spent progressively from 1982 to 2007. And there's three different ways to get federal funding for abstinence-only programs. There's the Title V that you can get money under. There's something called community-based abstinence education. And there's also the AFLA.
So check them out. With the Pennsylvania primary happening tomorrow, and two of the Democratic candidates being neck and neck, every single issue could be a deal breaker, even if there's only slight to nearly invisible differences between the candidates. The issue of reproductive rights is one where there's been a lot of fussing, even though a sober assessment of the candidates shows that they're basically the same on the issues. There was a recent Compassion Forum that appeared to be all about religion, which irritated me, because I'm not religious and I have compassion to spare, and many religious people I can think of don't. Still, the issue of abortion was bound to come up, so here's a review of the media traps and political answers that resulted. First off, Barack Obama gets presented with the pointless question.
Do you personally believe that life begins at conception? And if not, when does it begin?
You know, this is something that I have not... I think, come to a firm resolution on. I think it's very hard to know what that means. When life begins, is it when a cell separates? Is it when the soul stirs? I don't presume to know the answer to that question. What I know, as I've said before, is that there is something extraordinarily powerful about potential life, and that that has a moral weight to it that we take into consideration when we're having these debates.
He does pretty good with it, but I think a pro-choice politician would be better off saying, I can't know that, like he does here, and then starts in by saying, but what's really at stake is not so much when life begins, but whether or not a woman has a right to control her body. As long as you let the anti-choicers determine the frame of the argument, you're needlessly giving them ground they don't deserve. And this is about a woman's right to control her body more than it could ever be about when life begins. After all, most of us don't think life begins before you put on the condom, so why are anti-choicers hostile to the use of condoms? Then some really creepy dude gets up and talks up an abstinence-only program as some sort of magic bullet that improved things in Uganda in terms of HIV. That's something of a sleazy thing to say, because he neglects to mention that while it did have some effect, it wasn't as good as a more comprehensive approach. Obama's answer?
By the way, this is an area where, this doesn't happen very often, so everybody should take note, where I compliment George Bush. I actually think that, the PEPFAR program is one of the success stories of this administration. We've seen a drastic increase in funding and terrific work's being done between the CDC, the NIH, local AIDS organizations, NGOs. My view is that we should use whatever the best approaches are, the scientifically sound approaches are, to reduce this devastating disease all across the world. And part of that I think, should be a strong education component, and I think abstinence education is important. I also think that contraception is important. I also think that treatment is important. I also think that we have to do more to make antiviral drugs available to people who are in extreme poverty. So I don't want to pluck out one facet of it. Now, that doesn't mean that non-for-profit groups can't focus on one thing while the government focuses on other things. I think, you know, we want to have a comprehensive approach. I do think that, and I said this when I was in Kenya, that there is a behavioral element to AIDS that has to be addressed. And if there's promiscuity, and we are pretending that that's not an issue in spreading AIDS, then we're missing part of the answer. But I also think that, keep in mind, women are far more likely to be infected now between the ages of 18 and 25 than are men.
Sorry to quote at length, but he made some really great points about how useless abstinence only is. I think everyone agrees that behavioral education that puts the emphasis on safer sex practices, which includes some monogamy and abstaining, is good. But refusing to teach about condoms doesn't do anything but keep people from using them when they do have sex. Okay, now on to Hillary Clinton having to deal with the red herring question.
Senator, do you believe personally that life begins at conception?
I believe that the potential for life begins at conception. But for me, it is also not only about a potential life, it is about the other lives involved. And therefore, I have concluded, after great, concern and searching my own mind and heart over many years, that our task should be in this pluralistic, diverse life of ours in this nation, that individuals must be entrusted to make this profound decision, because the alternative would be such an intrusion of government authority that it would be very difficult to sustain in our kind of open society.
Again, it's about as good an answer as you can give outside of calling out the question for being a red herring and pointing out that the real issue is whether women have a basic right to autonomy. But she doesn't compromise on this issue much, which I appreciate. She then makes me really, really happy and points out that there's a link between forcing childbirth and forcing abortion. Again, this isn't about life or respecting it, but about controlling women's bodies and fertility. And who gets that right? Women? The state? Their families? Clinton draws this line to clarify that it's about women's rights.
Some of you know I went to China in 1995 and spoke out against the Chinese government's one-child policy, which led to forced abortions and forced sterilizations, because I believed that we needed to bear witness against what was an intrusive, abusive, dehumanizing effort to dictate how women and men would proceed with respect to the children they wished to have. And then shortly after that, I was in Romania. And there I met women who had been subjected to the communist regime of the 1970s and 80s, where they were essentially forced to bear as many children as possible for the good of the state, and where abortion was criminalized and women were literally forced to have physical exams and followed by the secret police. And so many children were abandoned and left to the orphanages that unfortunately led to an AIDS epidemic. So
it's important to make these links. I highly recommend a politician just replying, "When life begins is a matter of personal belief, but a woman's right to control her body belongs in the realm of public policy." Interestingly, and this is completely an unscientific observation, there seems to be a lot more anti-choice material out there denouncing Obama for being pro-choice than Clinton. I'm not sure why anti-choicers are focusing their energy on him. Maybe it's because Clinton's views have already been well publicized and Obama's less so. I doubt anyone could actually view Obama as anything but pro-choice, but you never know. Maybe the anti-choicers just really hate him because he made a fool out of Jill Stanek when she testified in front of the Illinois legislature years ago. I'd like to welcome Martha Burke to the program. Martha is a political psychologist and a women's equity expert who is the co-founder and president of the Center for Advancement of Public Policy. She currently serves as the chair of the National Council of Women's Organizations. She's here today to talk about her new book, Your Money and Your Life, The High Stakes for Women Voters in 08 and Beyond. Welcome to RealityCast, Martha.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
So why is 08 a big year for women's issues?
Well, for a number of reasons. Of course, I think every election year is a big year for women's issues, but primarily this year is important because we have a chance to turn the corner. We've lost a lot in the last 8 years under the Bush administration, and what we do as women voters and participants in the public dialogue is going to make all the difference for the next 8 years.
Are there issues you think aren't raising enough concern for women when they should be?
There are issues I think are not raising enough concern for women. There are issues I think that the candidates are not raising enough that women care about. And finally, there are issues that everybody cares about but that affect women and men differently, and the candidates are not talking about that. And all of those reasons are the reasons I wrote the book. The book is designed for women who are engaged civically, but they don't have time to live and breathe politics. They don't have time maybe to keep up with everything that's going on Capitol Hill every day, or what the candidates may or may not be talking about. So this book is sort of a quick way to familiarize yourself with the issues and what the gender implications are of various issues and where we stand and what we stand to gain or lose.
Can you give me an example of a couple of issues you feel are being neglected by the candidates this election season?
Well, yeah, I think that by and large, pay equity, which always polls very high with women, is not totally being ignored. Senator Clinton does bring it up occasionally. None of the other candidates do, to my knowledge. And it's something women care very much about. They want to know what can be done to close that pay gap, which is very stubborn and is not good for women or their families.
One of the major reasons women don't get politically involved is that between our jobs and the second shift at home, we just don't have the time. How do you suggest women get past this problem?
Well, I think getting yourself educated in a quick, easily understandable way is one of the ways, and that's why I wrote the book, because I know women are busy. And it's a book that is short. It has issues divided. For example, if your main issue is child care and you want to know why we don't have child care, you can dive in and read about that. On the other hand, if Social Security is something you're very concerned about, you can read about that. It's not something that you have to go front to back and read every word. Now, having said that, there are other places women can get past this barrier you're talking about, such as the Internet. There's a lot of information out there, but it's very hard to sit down and filter through all that. One of the things that I do every night that I think women can do and they maybe not think about, I usually try to time my dinner cooking when it's my night to cook with the evening news. So because you don't have to really watch the news, you can just listen to it. And so I do that, try to double task that way. Same way if you're driving, listen to some news radio or talk radio that interests you, and you can kind of keep up that way a little bit.
I have to add that podcasts are an excellent thing to listen to during your driving time.
Absolutely.
What kind of issue are you referring to as an example of something that affects both men and women but in a different way?
Healthcare. is a good example. More women than men are going without health care because they don't have coverage through their jobs. A lot of women work part-time, or they take off part of the year due to caregiving duties and that sort of thing. And so they don't have access to company-provided health care in the same way that men do. Again, going back to the pay gap, health care is less affordable for women because we make less. Thirdly, there are things that are not covered. One of the most outrageous things to me is that insurance plans cover Viagra and they don't cover birth control. These are some of the kinds of gender issues that fold into the health care debate. Everybody's concerned about health care access and cost, but it does differentially affect women.
Does your book have information in it about how somebody can proceed to influence the 2008 election? That's very timely information, but is that part of your book?
Yes, it is. Every chapter ends with questions you should ask candidates, and that's candidates at every level, because what happens at the federal level can affect what happens at the local level. And so we try to give the readers a quick way to address the candidates. Here's a question to ask them, and don't let them get away with generalities. Be specific, and we give some of those examples of specific questions that candidates ought to be able to answer if they really care about women voters, which, by the way, we do talk a lot about women as voters and women as the majority of the electorate, because women do have the power to elect the President of the United States.
So you're saying that women actually vote more than men do?
Yes. Women are the majority in the population. They are the majority of registered voters, and their turnout for the last 15 years has been higher than men's turnout. So yes, the election, women have the power to control any election.
Are there ways for women to be proactive on the issue of reproductive health policy, or do you think we're stuck in defensive maneuvers right now?
Well, we're stuck in defensive maneuvers as long as there is a Congress that is hostile to reproductive freedom. And we've had that until 2006. But even since 2006, the pro-choice majority is not huge. It's only a 1 or 2 vote majority. And this is something else I go into in the book, and that is that size matters. And when I say that, size of the majority in Congress. A lot of people think, well, what's the difference? You know, 1 or 2 more Republicans, 1 or 2 more Democrats, 1 or 2 more pro-choice or anti-choice, but it makes a huge difference because whoever is in control controls the agenda. They control what gets heard before the committees, what comes to the floor for a vote, and what is bottled up and not voted on. Another thing that people don't think often enough about often enough, speaking of reproductive rights, is that a lot goes on below the congressional level that affects women's lives profoundly. And by that I mean things like appointments that the president will make to the cabinet, to the government agencies. Is money being funneled away from reproductive care in favor of, say, a marriage initiative, which has happened under the Bush administration? Has funding been cut for birth control on campus, as it has under the Bush administration? Have they put in copays for poor women trying to get reproductive health care under Medicaid? The answer is yes, under the Bush administration. So those things are very important for voters to understand, that while you don't get to vote on that issue directly, when you cast your vote for a candidate, you are voting for or against policies like that affect real women's lives.
If you'd like to learn more, please check out Martha's book, Your Money and Your Life, available at the Ms. Bookstore. Thank you so much for coming on to RealityCast, Martha.
It's my pleasure, and the web link is MsMagazine.com.
Now listen up.
all the hefty political talk, I figured you, the listening audience, deserves a laugh. So what better to laugh at than the book world's version of snake oil salespeople? Those who write books on sex and relationships. I don't mean actual sex-positive types like yours truly or Dan Savage or Lynn Harris. No, it's not advice I have a problem with, but the whole thing about how men are from Mars and women are from Venus and how we can be judged as groups instead of individuals. It's sexist and it's heterosexist and it contributes to conservative views that are bad for improving sexual health, and it's fun to mock. And where better to find this sort of thinking than the Today Show? I knew I'd hit gold when they had a woman named Alison Grams who calls herself the man translator. If you thought men spoke languages like Spanish, Russian, or English, think again. Apparently, they speak another language called man, and Alison has to translate for women.
Let's pretend you're talking to a man, and he says, and here's the quote, he says, "That is interesting."
Yeah.
Okay, what does he mean when he says that's very interesting?
I have no idea what you said because I wasn't listening.
Okay, all right.
Ha ha. Because God knows no man would actually lower himself to listen to a woman and find what she says interesting. What I never get about these sort of dating advice books and columns is that they never explain why, if men think women are stupid and silly, women should ever spend our time with them. For sex? I think you can probably get sex without having to get into a relationship with someone who thinks that you have nothing to say worth listening to.
I love this one. Number two, I am close with my mother. What does "I'm close with my mother" mean?
I live with my mother.
Does it really?
Yeah, it really does. I'm
okay.
Sorry.
What about number three? I am in between jobs right now.
Translation, I am unemployed.
Unemployed.
Yeah.
Women are fully capable of being broke and having to rely on our parents. So I don't get why these are only man things to say. Maybe they think it's only important for men to have jobs. Maybe. They need to join the 21st century then, because being an underemployed and dependent woman is only considered attractive in Bible-thumping communities.
I want to take this one slowly. What does he mean?
I'm going to count to three and then grab your left breast.
What?
The camera guy likes that.
Okay.
Dude, that didn't even make sense. Would it have been fast if it were the right breast? It's a non-joke. It's like saying, okay, let's marry two stereotypes together that men are the only gender that likes sex and that men are liars. Sure, it doesn't quite follow that a man would lie to you about his sexual intentions right before pushing for sex, but your problem is that you expect jokes to make sense.
You have here, can I buy you a drink? That seems very straightforward to me.
Yeah, but not necessary. Like after midnight in a bar, that means the less sober you are, the easier this is going to be for me.
So can I buy you a drink means what?
Basically means yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hey ladies, did you know that men who want to buy you drinks in a bar are hitting on you? No? Yeah, no's not the right answer. No one would say no. Carry on.
Sure, I'll call you. How does that translate?
Oh, this one breaks my heart. It usually means, you know, you stand like a better chance of hearing from Jimmy Hoffa than getting a call from me again.
It breaks my heart because it's so unoriginal. But now I'm feeling guilty because I've got a new book out that's a similar humorous guide thingy called It's a Jungle Out There. It's possible I have jokes in there that are this tired. But probably not. I do know that writing jokes is really hard and the temptation to go for the "I'll call you" joke is strong. But I don't know. Since I'm working this new territory where I believe men and women are actually from the same planet and speaking the same language, I like to think that freshens it up a bit. Also, I have jokes about singing fetuses in my book, which probably permanently preempts me from getting a plug on the Today Show. And now for the wisdom of Wingnuts. Now that Bill O'Reilly has odious woman and gay hater Mark Rudoff on his show, I feel that Rudoff's going to be a ripe source of Wingnut wisdom. At least until he crosses a line and finally gets his ass fired.
Well, I think we are promoting a homosexual lifestyle. And I fear for the long-term consequences for children. You know, just this week a report came out that said using cell phones is more dangerous than smoking, but the effects are very long-term. If there's going to be a brain tumor, it might not be discovered for 10 years. And I kind of look at this in the same way, because children do form their sexual identities from their same-sex parents. And what's going on here is basically teaching children that there's no difference between a heterosexual marriage and a homosexual marriage.
I love the logic of these arguments. The problem with treating gays and lesbians as equal is that kids will grow up thinking gays and lesbians deserve equality. Can you imagine making the same argument about race? That bringing kids up in a mixed race neighborhood is bad because it teaches them not to be racist? There's no other way to understand Rudolph's comment than to say that he thinks gays and lesbians should be second-class citizens because he just thinks so, nah. Not that it should matter, but there's no reason to think that having gay parents makes you more or less likely to be gay. Most gay people come from straight parents, of course, so if preventing a new generation of kids from turning gay at the steady rate of 2-10% of the population is Rudolph's goal, then he needs to agitate for a ban on the existence of children completely, just to be safe.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.